Radio Decidimos.
Okay. Hola, hola a todas, a todos. Muchas gracias por estar aquí. Quisiera empezar agradeciendo a la organización del Decidim Fest, a la Dirección de Innovación Democrática del Ayuntamiento de Barcelona y al CCCB por haber hecho posible esta invitación a Mackenzie Work. La verdad es que hemos tenido la suerte de contar con Mackenzie para dos eventos. El primero de ellos fue el martes pasado en el CCCB. Estuvimos discutiendo con ella desde el colectivo Vector, también el editor de Olobionte, y la verdad que fue un seminario muy fructífero, también muy largo, y salieron cosas súper interesantes. Y hoy tenemos la suerte de tener una charla con ella aquí en el marco del Decidim Fest. Y yo creo que será una conversación muy interesante porque también la comunidad que está alrededor del Decidim Fest tiene mucho que ver con la clase hacker, que es algo a lo que Mackenzie ha dedicado mucho de su trabajo, está dedicado a pensar esta clase. Creo que toda esta comunidad se podrá sentir muy identificada con ello. Así que muchísimas gracias a Mackenzie Work por la disponibilidad para hacer estos dos eventos en tan poco tiempo durante su estadía. Y bueno, no quiero tomar mucho tiempo, imagino que quizás muchas de ustedes ya conocen el trabajo de ella, pero quizás otras no tanto, entonces voy a hacer como una pequeña presentación. Mackenzie Work es profesora de Media Culture en el New York School for Social Research. Ha publicado un montón de libros, son tantos que realmente no me va a dar el tiempo para nombrarlos a todos, pero tiene un trabajo en el cual ha generado reflexiones en torno a la interrelación entre tecnología, política, economía, género, ecología, y simplemente por nombrar algunos, ha publicado Manifiesto Hacker, La Teoría Gamer, Molécula Red, que es una teoría para el antropoceno, El Capitalismo ha Muerto, que está recientemente traducido por Olobionte y es uno de los libros que estuvimos discutiendo en el CCB en el seminario, y seguramente hoy también saldrán ideas de este libro. Y los más recientes, Rivers Cowgirl y Sensoria, que creo que aún no está en traducción ninguno de los dos, tendremos que esperar. Y yo creo que una de las cosas más interesantes del trabajo de Work es que ella como que nos incita a tener una sensibilidad o a estar atentas frente a las realidades emergentes, ¿no? Y en ese sentido presta mucha atención a las prácticas, a las técnicas, a las culturas. Técnicas, lo digo en sentido amplio, y no digo tecnologías, ¿no? Las prácticas están muy relacionadas con las técnicas y no solo las tecnologías, y las técnicas pues involucran también modos de vida, formas de experiencia, ¿no? Y en este incitarnos a mirar allí, ella, una de las cosas que creo que pone sobre la mesa su trabajo es no asumir que las cadenas a las que estamos sometidas son cadenas que ya conocemos o que se van a mantener siempre igual. Y es decir, entonces la forma de desencadenarnos o de liberarnos de ciertas restricciones en relación a la tecnología o a otras cuestiones como la política, no las podemos dar por sentadas de algún modo, ¿no? Y en este sentido, la conciencia de clase es algo esencial para poder salir una de estas limitaciones. Pero ella plantea las cosas en un aspecto en el que antes de preguntarnos en qué clase social estamos y a qué clase social pertenecemos, tenemos que hacernos la pregunta de en qué sistema de producción estamos viviendo. Y eso implica, a pesar de la resistencia que puede generar esta pregunta, tanto de la derecha como desde la izquierda, eso implica permitirnos preguntarnos si las relaciones de producción que se establecen a través de las tecnologías digitales hacen que sigamos en el mismo sistema de producción, si seguimos en el capitalismo o no. Aceptar que el capitalismo puede ser una realidad que no es una esencia inmutable y que en ese sentido podemos devolver esta categoría a su sentido histórico y comprender que puede llegar a tener un principio y un fin, y si es el fin, que es lo que viene, ¿no? Que es lo que viene después, es algo peor quizás. Esta pregunta está llena de otras preguntas, ¿no? ¿Qué tipo de nuevas formas de propiedad intelectual son aquellas que están siendo cooptadas por las clases dominantes? ¿Qué tipo de comunes están siendo dominados por asimetrías de poder? Y finalmente, ¿qué posibilidades de hackear esa propiedad privada que se hace cada vez más abstracta, ¿no? Y esa propiedad privada se hace más abstracta muchas veces en relación a este tipo de tecnologías. Así que, bueno, yo no me voy a extender mucho más porque hay poco tiempo. Tendremos intervención en inglés y una de las cosas que quería decir es que hay traducción simultánea, entonces se pueden acercar a pedir, sí, el dispositivo para poder ir siguiendo la charla en la traducción al, no sé si es al catalán o al castellano. Y luego habrá, media hora de presentación de Mackenzie Work y luego abriremos la ronda de preguntas, ¿vale? So, thank you very much. We can start with your presentation.
See if this works. Nope, I'll try again. Yes. All right, that's my second slide. All right, that'll do. We'll start there. My thanks to Desidim for having me. My thanks to Alejandra for the introduction. I do apologize that I can only address you in English. Most of the material I'm drawing on is in these two books, which are both available in Spanish. A Hacker Manifesto is 15 years old. Capital is Dead just came out in Spanish, thanks to Holobionte. All right, let's have a go at this. All right, so what I'm going to try and do is try to sort of frame with a big picture how we might think about the contemporary struggles around information that we're stuck with today. And the provocation that I want to start with is the subtitle of the English edition of Capital is Dead. What if this isn't even capitalism anymore that we're living in, but something worse? So maybe the language that we're using, the conceptual tools, the forms of organizing, maybe there's reasons they sometimes don't get purchase, is that we're actually looking at something that, at least at the top level, is a slightly different kind of social technical apparatus than the one that we were taught to think that we might be living inside of. So let's just sort of take that as a thought experiment, a provocation. What if it's not capitalism anymore? It's something worse. Then what are the consequences of that for popular and democratic organizing? Would that give us like a reframing of how our activities, how our struggles, how our alliances, how the contradictions, might it give us a slightly different picture of all of that? So that's what I want to sort of do a little bit today. All right, so the basic idea in the two books that I'm referring to here would be to see history as, modern history as commodification that took place in three stages, and where those stages are each qualitatively a little bit different. So stage one is the commodification of the means of agricultural production. And sometimes we leave that bit out, but maybe that's sort of a little bit separate to capitalism as a kind of industrial system. The transformation of a sort of a peasant economy where there's sort of reciprocal relations with the nobility into tenant farmers who are paying rent to a landlord class that's then able to extract rent based on the monopolization of the ownership of land is a whole stage in the development of the abstraction of commodification. But land is a sort of a somewhat fixed commodity, if you like. It's a particular place. It has particular productivity and so forth. Capitalism sort of transforms that. It's abstract in a more general sense. The factory can be anywhere, the system of distribution, but capitalism is the development of ways of owning the means of production as private property. And it creates a kind of different subordinate class to the tenant farmer on the land. It creates the working class. And the commodification of land through a surplus population off the land into the cities, that then, because they have nothing to sell but their labor, those workers become subordinated to a capitalist class. This is the traditional story as we have it in Marx, yeah? Well, what I want to add to that is, what if there's a third stage in the abstraction of the commodity form that is different again, and has to do with the commodification not of land, not of capital in the sense of the factory and the means of production, but in the sense of information? And what does it mean for the top level of economic domination to be about control through information of capital, of land, and where you're producing not two, but then three subordinate classes, and a relationship between not two, landlord and capitalist, but three kinds of ruling class. The more recent one is then controlling through information. So that's the sort of basic argument of the book. And as I say, let's take it as a thought experiment. We sort of have gotten into the habit of thinking that capitalism is sort of something that's kind of eternal. We just modify it a little bit and it's still basically the same thing. So we had Fordist capitalism, then post-Fordist capitalism, then neoliberal capitalism. At what point does it become something that's qualitatively different? That's the question that I want to ask. So as I'm suggesting, maybe there's specific forms of class conflict specific to each era in the evolution of the abstraction of the commodity form. So the first version of that is farmers versus landlords, and the typical forms of resistance that farmers, when able to articulate their interests as a class, had against the landlord class, which tended to involve burning down the manor, that kind of thing. Then we had workers versus capitalists, the introduction of the tactic of the strike, for example, or of sabotage, other ways you can interrupt the flow of production at the site of production to be able to make demands on the from the point of view of a subordinate class of workers. But where that depended on there being choke points in how capitalist organization of manufacturing worked. So if you shut down the railway or you blockade the factory, you can interrupt the circuit of production. But maybe that's a little harder in an era when the whole of production, distribution, consumption is organized through flexible systems of information that you can route around the possibilities of labor to organize itself. And you can also outsource production away from wherever labor happens to be. And maybe that's one of the big stories about the 70s, is capital starts to outshore production, so you just withdraw production from labor that's resisting you and put it somewhere else. But maybe in the process, investing so heavily in the means of information control, that information control itself became a means of domination, even over capital itself. So what if there's a new kind of ruling class added on top of the other two? I called it vectoralist class. I mean, call it what you like. I'm not wedded to this language. The word vector, common to most European languages, just means a line of fixed length but no fixed position. And we can think of everything to do with information as working like that, yeah? There's a certain set of properties that communicating with a cell phone has, but it works anywhere. I can connect to any point in the sort of information sphere with this device. So the fixed qualities but the flexibility of information as a means of communication and control is the thing that maybe reshapes the whole of production, consumption, distribution, and so on. And that's the thing that I want to sort of get at here. So what if at the top level, control of a political economy, control of surveillance? What if all of those things was now in the space of, let's call it a vector field, where you're tracking the movement of raw materials, of finished goods, of labor, of the consumer, pretty much in real time as it moves through the entire cycle of extraction, production, distribution, consumption, and then the movement of social reproduction of workers through the rest of their lives? Because, you know, I hate to tell you, you probably already know that these things, just walking around with it is throwing off streams of data to who knows how many companies that have access to the data that you're producing just by walking around. So what if at the top level, the way the ruling class now works is through the extraction of surplus information? And then what if the design of that information system is really just only for the purpose of extracting surplus information out of all of us? So we're often told that these things are for our convenience and that they create a public sphere or so forth, but they're really not. They're not really designed for us. They're designed to get something out of us. So I think that poses a lot of questions about why it seems so badly designed and why the information sphere doesn't work the way it's advertised as supposedly working. So if the information systems that we're embedded in are designed really just to extract surplus information out of us, that might account for why they don't work very well for democracy, they don't work very well for culture, why we end up in endless kind of Twitter fights, why we have so much disinformation, because it's not really designed to do anything other than extract surplus information out of us. And to extract surplus information not just out of labor, but out of non-labor, which is a somewhat paradoxical idea, like what's non-labor? So even when I'm not working, I'm still working for the man, so to speak. I'm still producing information for, you know, Google or Apple or whoever, who's then able to, by giving me little bits of information when I want it, but extracting all of the information in the aggregate out of all of us, and then treating that as proprietary and being able to shape corporate strategies based on that. That might be the world that we're now in. So it's an unequal information exchange. It seems I get for free the location of this venue so I could find it on the subway, or the time of my flight tomorrow. I get little bits of information, but all of us in aggregate are producing information for a ruling class that doesn't give it back to us, that treats it as its own private property. And maybe it's not just our labor that gets commodified now, but what I'm going to semi-seriously call our communism is a thing that gets commodified and taken away from us. So our desire to share, to be with others, to have community, to make things freely available to each other, that's the very thing that now gets commodified. So paradoxically, the very possibility of small c communism, the things we want to share and give to each other outside of the commodity, is the very thing that now gets commodified. So what happens if we want counter strategies to that? How do we work in that environment? Are there ways that traditional forms of social and cultural and political organizing and this new environment might meet? You know, like what are the possibilities for a world that we might want in relation to that? So part of the problem is a kind of outflanking of the traditional forms of popular organization, such as unions, parties, cooperatives, social movements. We still have those, but I think we maybe share a common sense that the political parties are sort of shells of them of their former selves. It gets harder to organize unions and to organize around labor. That the cooperative becomes something else, becomes a different kind of organization. And it becomes difficult to use the traditional tactics that popular movements used to use. What's a strike in relation to information, like what's an information strike? It seems hard to sort of think that. Now, of course, there are still real strikes. You can shut down production at a particular place, but that's not helpful if there's a system of information that can route around the particular blockage that you're trying to affect with the strike. We can still demonstrate, but does demonstrating still actually work? You can still occupy a physical place, but America, we had the slogan, Occupy Wall Street, but how do you occupy an abstraction? Like, Wall Street's not really a physical place. It's a sort of metaphor for the global circulation of capital at the speed of light. How do you occupy that? So you could symbolically occupy a space near Wall Street called Zuccotti Park. 20 years, how long ago was it? 10 years ago today? Sorry, not 20. So you can symbolically occupy it, but you can't really occupy it. And frankly, it's got to be said, riot is still a strategy, particularly in relation to information policing. In the context of the United States, this is heavily racialized. The use of violence by the police provokes the refusal to be policed in the form of civil unrest, right? So it's a strategy that you can use to some extent, but the means of surveillance of populations who are attempting that are ever more intricate than they ever used to be before. During Black Lives Matter in New York City, the NYPD arrested 400 people crossing Brooklyn Bridge and then released them without charges. And my suspicion is the reason they did that was just to gather data, to find out what a sample of the population who were protesting was for the purposes of surveillance and intelligence, right? Rather than to really arrest anybody. So it gets hard to use traditional forms of political and social organization. So we can think about temporary measures in relation to the situation that we find ourselves in. And quite frankly, I came here to learn how it's done in Catalonia and Barcelona, because it seems that some of the strategies around this here are more advanced than the ones I'm familiar with in the United States. But we can figure out experiments in combining traditional forms and tactics with the available contemporary social media. So we learned a lot from Occupy Wall Street, from the Arab Spring, from Black Lives Matter, the Indignados here, and so on, about you get one moment where you can outflank the police by using a new tool, but you don't get two moments to do that. If you're organizing around Facebook before they figure out that you can do it, it'll work for a while, then they figure out you're using Facebook and it'll be under surveillance, full of disinformation, false flag operations, that sort of thing. So you only get to do it once. And I think we learned particularly from Arab Spring. I had a graduate student who did work on that. The security agencies aren't fools, and they figure this out pretty quickly. And the thing we know is that a lot of these corporate platforms are going to cooperate very readily with the security apparatus and very quickly. So you don't get very long to use a new tool. Maybe there's like 5 minutes where you could use TikTok for organizing before anybody figures out you're doing it, and then you'll get shut down. It'll be fun for a minute, and then you have to move on to something else. Yeah. And remember, of course, none of these tools are really designed for these purposes in the first place, so they're not going to work very well for doing that. But we'll do our best, right? So I'm pointing to some of the limitations that the existing design of not just social media, but the entire kind of information apparatus that's really there to extract surplus information out of populations, out of flows of goods, out of flows of capital, flows of derivatives. None of it's built for us. It's built to extract something out of us. So it's readily available for surveillance, and that has a chilling effect, a dampening effect on people's willingness to participate. And one can get very paranoid about that. The powers that be don't really usually care about any of us individually, but they might be looking for patterns in how people are responding to forms of oppression or exploitation. You get a lot of noise. If anybody's been on social media, you know that most of it is noise, that you're dealing with stuff that's seemingly random and poorly sourced. and is going down, you know, sort of rabbit holes of useless information around anything. A lot of it is unverified and unverifiable. Who knows if any of these things are true? Conspiracy theories become very popular. There's a conspiracy theory that Australia, where I come from, doesn't exist because the Earth is flat and there's no southern hemisphere. So I am a paid agent of NASA. And the reason this happened is because the British Empire didn't really transport us there. It just threw us overboard from the ships. And this is so scandalous that we've had to lie about it for 2 centuries. So thank you, NASA. I assume the check is in the mail. Marsupials aren't real. They're all genetically engineered in some lab in Area 51. And obviously, this is an extreme example, and very few people believe this. But you understand that, you know, the temptation to believe these things is probably quite real because we often feel like the consensus reality that we're in doesn't really seem to add up. So people go to these kind of extreme versions of thinking there must be something else that's real and true. So noise, disinformation, there's probably a lot of intentionally seeded disinformation and a lot of paranoia about that. I don't know about here, but in the last election cycle in the United States, this like huge paranoid conspiracy theory that the Russians are subverting the American elections. And it's like, I thought subverting other people's elections was what the CIA did, right? Like, I think America's really good at that, but then there's this whole thing about, wait, other people are subverting our election, like as if that's not supposed to happen, you know? But as we say in English, turnaround's fair play, yeah? I don't know if how true those rumors are or how much influence, you know, like Russian disinformation really had. And of course, most of this is unverifiable. How do you verify information in this environment? So how do we use a media design to extract surplus from us to organize against it becomes a kind of significant problem. And then one starts to deal with the noisy dynamics of an information sphere, find ways of seeding it with particular memes, but you have very little agency and control over them. So there's probably a whole series of tactics for doing that, and ways in which a great deal of organizing really still has to happen with real people in real spaces, yeah? I don't know if anybody here has heard of an American politician called Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who became the sort of standard bearer of the social democratic left within the Democratic Party in the United States. I'm from the district that she represents. And the way that that campaign worked was literally knocking on people's doors rather than relying on a media campaign like all of the other candidates did. So the various progressive organizations literally went door to door, you know, talking to people, finding out what issues mattered to people. So sometimes, you know, it's not the new shiny internet strategy that's going to work. Sometimes it's real physical organizing that's going to make a real difference. But clearly, we need to think about what would be forms of information circulation, management that would be appropriate for forms of self-organization. So how do we think about information in terms of self-defense so that popular movements and even just people in everyday life, people from minority cultures, I'm one as a trans woman, I kind of need a little bubble, I need a little space where we can have information, where we're not continually under attack. So what can we do about designing tools for democratic, popular, or minority organization? And maybe those tools would start to look different to the ones that were provided that are really just there to extract information from us. But there's a second piece to this. It's one thing to think about people, you know, what I call the hacker class, you know, people who specialize in creating and organizing information. It's one thing to think of people from that class to which I belong making a contribution to the design of better tools and the creation of new forms of information regulation for all of us. But one has to think the other side of that as well. How do we let the democratic process into the design of those tools as well? So those of us who think we understand the form and content of information aren't just acting like experts who come from without. How do we change our working methods so that those of us who specialize in the design of information, form and content are working with people who are communities, who have issues, who are social movements, to sort of break down that difference? And I think that's one of the main issues and struggles at the moment, is to sort of bridge those sorts of gaps between different kinds of knowledge, different kinds of ways of working, different kinds of expertise. And to recognize that everybody's got expertise about how culture can work, how communication can work. I want to say a little bit about information ecology, and particularly ecologies of attention. The thing about information is there always seems to be just too much of it. Like, information is everywhere. Of the thousands of things I could occupy my time with on my phone, what do I pick? I really try to read the New York Times, which is a reasonably good newspaper, but I spend half my time on Twitter. Just like shitposting, basically. I don't know how you translate shitposting into Spanish. I hope there's a local equivalent of that one. But so, you know, my attention gets sort of distracted to things that seem sort of unimportant, but which manage my, you know, sort of emotional well-being, maybe. And I want to borrow a little bit from my friend Yves Citon, who talks about four kinds of attention, and to think about the way that the media sphere operates in relation to those four kinds of attention. And he calls them alertness, loyalty, projection, and immersion. And we sort of need all of them, and none of them are necessarily bad, but that we sometimes end up in information systems much more designed around alertness and loyalty than around projection and immersion. And so maybe we need to think about rebalancing our attention and then designing together tools that help with that rebalancing. So loyalty as a kind of attention sort of hypnotizes us into thinking, that's where I belong, I'm the same as that, I belong with those people. So I'm paying attention because that's the thing I want to belong to or want to identify with. Identity politics is all about that, that's my people, and those are not my people. Like the downside of loyalty is you're sort of thinking about somebody else as the enemy. So it's kind of can be galvanizing that you're connected to something, but you're then not attending to certain other subtleties and certain other problems. And it can connect to alertness. I don't know if you have anything like Fox News in the Spanish context, but if anybody's seen Fox News in America, it's always like, you really should be worried about this thing. This thing is terrible. They're going to ban Christmas. There's transgender people everywhere, and they're a menace. They're going to do this, and you're not allowed to use this word anymore. So it's all like hyper alertness all the time. Like, all of these things are scary. So it's a very particular kind of attention that gets you tense, and then you focus. And you can insert the advertising in the middle of that. It's no accident a lot of these hyper right-wing media sites advertise gold. Yeah, you're supposed to then buy gold because you're so paranoid about the world, you know, like they're going to come and get us, so we better get gold, you know. So there's a way in which it's kind of like bad attention that's obviously just aimed at extracting surplus information out of us, selling us some useless stuff. I mean, what are you supposed to do with the gold? It's not like you can eat it. So maybe we need to balance our attention a little bit and think about immersion, rather than think I'm separate from the world, so I'm alert or scared of it. How am I immersed in the world as a form of attention, where I can let go of my barriers a little bit and belong to something, participate in something, yeah? How can I have a kind of attention that projects me into something else, where I'm no longer caught up in being myself? I'm like, oh, I can imagine what it would be like to be someone else, or more interestingly, something else, yeah? I'll come back to this, but how does it feel to be something else, not just someone else? So I get out of that sense of I have to be alert to dangers around my own boundaries, yeah? And sort of only like wedded to the people I feel who kind of are kind of like me. So maybe one thing we could think about when we're designing not just the actual sort of like the tools and the technical part of alternative communication, but the culture of it. Yeah, like what's the sort of cultural space we're trying to create where it might have elements of all of those and where we might need to switch between them. In the middle of a crisis, maybe alertness is a good thing and you don't want to be all relaxed and immersed when there's an actual crisis happening. But how do we know the crisis is real? And maybe we could use our immersive and projective ability to see whether the crisis is actually real or if we're just getting scared and paranoid for no reason because it suits some, you know, sort of branch of the ruling class to make us feel that way. So the media that we're operating in don't really balance those four kinds of attention because some are easier to exploit for the purpose of extracting surplus information and selling us useless stuff than others are. So we don't really have an information ecology that's designed for us to feel good about ourselves, let alone be able to organize ourselves. So yeah, like we all then start to feel terrible. So then they're all offering us a bunch of commodities and things to make us feel better. So you get hooked on buying more stuff. So what would it mean to create cultures and media vectors that work differently, that enable us to live richer, fuller lives, but also to be able to self-organize around popular demands against exploitation, against oppression? That would, I think, be the, you know, sort of the big question in not just media theory, but media practice at the moment. So we have an information economy, an attention economy, trying to grab and hold onto our attention because attention is scarce. We don't have an information ecology, and that's the thing we might want to start to think about. Because we end up in these feedback loops. Positive feedback loop sounds like a good thing. It's not. Positive feedback loop's a bad thing because it gets more hyper and more, so we get... I'm sort of alert, so that makes me scared, that makes me sort of loyal to a little narrow group, and that makes me more alert, and you end up in this cycle that's going to sort of drive you crazy. All right, so I'm at 30 minutes, and I'm going to wrap it up in just a second. So, yeah, Lex, how do we get out of that by designing things a little differently? Some points towards that. Balancing forms of attention, which I've expanded on a little bit because I think that's a little bit of a slightly counterintuitive one, maybe a slightly different one. And these other ones I think are probably fairly well known if you've been thinking about any of these issues. How do we encourage participation, not just in terms of reach, but quality of participation without requiring everybody to spend all of their time? As Oscar Wilde once said, the problem with socialism is it takes too many evenings. Yeah, right? How do we not spend all of our time in endless meetings but have some efficiency around that? Verification and trust. How do we establish trust in relation to each other? And that's where being physically present, co-present, is very helpful. And of course, COVID has given us some new problems to think about around that. Negative feedback's actually a good thing. Even if it's got the word negative in it. Negative feedback is that damping down. You know, something, some information spiral is happening. How do we unspiral it when everyone's getting paranoid about some particular thing? And how do we create forms of decision making that are inclusive but not endless, but not that endless series of evenings? To what extent can any of these ideas scale? That's the hard one. And that's where I think to be doing experiments on the local scale and the municipal scale and networking those might be the way to go about that, to think that. So the you know, municipal socialism is an old idea, but maybe we could sort of update that in terms of municipal information socialism. At that scale, it's maybe quite possible that the people have leverage, whereas at the national scale and certainly the global scale, we have less. And then that would allow experiments with forms where what happens in Madrid is different to what we're working on in Barcelona, is different to what we're working on in New York, but then how do we learn from each other and have networks of learning together about that? I just want to gesture a little bit to, so far I'm just talking about people and techniques, but we're living in the Anthropocene, like climate change is real. I don't know about here, but it's just been ridiculously hot for October in New York City, and that's probably not good. So how do we think about information coming from outside the human as being part of how we regulate and manage, particularly if we're increasingly in an era of the instability of certain conditions we take for granted about how we pass through our daily life? So ecologies of information that include the non-human. So what would a struggle for a flexible, democratic, sustainable information vector look like? That includes alliances of all the subordinate classes, but isn't just restricted to the human, but is thinking beyond it. That's, if you like, the sort of big picture that I'm trying to paint here a little bit. And sorry about all the new words, but that's my, so I figure that's my job, just make up words and see if you like them. You know, it's like poetry that works or it doesn't, take it or leave it. To think about like architectures of both built form and information, but there's something a little bit sort of fixed and solid about thinking architecture. So offering the word kinetecture is a way to think about what we might need to now build. Kinos is a word that means not just a new thing happening, but a qualitatively new thing happening in time. What if we're in a different kind of time now? And the common name, you can criticize it for that, is the Anthropocene. So what's the time of the Anthropocene? And I want to argue that what we're experiencing is the geological time is moving faster than historical time. So the weather is changing faster than our politics is or our technology is. And that's kind of alarming. So maybe we need to think about flexible, adaptable, resilient, robust ways that we can organize and use the kind of communication tools available to us to build something other than a vector that just extracts information out of us. I got to do a plug for the other people who invited me here, which is the CCCB has this great show called Science Fictions or Frictions, to sort of think through exactly that problem of how do we include things other than human actors and technology in our thinking about this. Great show, recommend it. And that's basically all I got to say. So for those who maybe, and I dearly thank the translator and hope I wasn't running too fast. I hope some of that makes sense. I hope some of it connects to the context. It's been a real pleasure to be here and learn about the work that's been happening in Barcelona, in Catalonia, and in Spain, Spain as well, and more on all of these topics in those two books. That's all from me. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you very much. That was very inspiring, a lot of things. It's nice to see how the conversation can expand from the CCCB seminar. So we are going to open a round of questions now. I will start with the first one, and then we can open to the audience. So I was thinking while I was listening to you, how can we create and design other types of tools in order to get this balance between these different kind of attention? Well, there is a personal kind of area of decision, but the design is already determining that too. So, in order to be able to design these kind of tools, and also in order to create more data diversity, that was something that we were talking just coming here. This idea of we need different kind of data because there is an hypertrophic production of personal data. Mm. So why do we need more personal data? What kind of data do we need to face the challenge of climate change, for example? So I was thinking, what do you think about the materials conditions? How can we do this possible in terms of technical infrastructure. So do we need to create more public infrastructure, how to reorient the budgets, or to make it to make this kind of technologies possible in the first place, no? Because we need like another material vector that is very concrete in terms of infrastructure. So do you think that we need more public infrastructure? What kind of problems that can have? And we must be aware also of that. Or maybe also autonomous infrastructures also is a possibility that can relate and not be antagonist.
Yeah, one level needs public infrastructure in relation to commodification and a kind of ruling class based on extracting information. So there's a way in which public infrastructure is sort of like a counter to that. And sometimes public infrastructure can partially decommodify some relations. But the problem with that, and I'm coming at this from living in the United States for a long time as well, public infrastructure often ends up captured by the ruling class and the interests of commodification, and gets hollowed out from the inside, but can also be subject to forms of political control that aren't helpful either. So how do you have public infrastructure that's then at the same time something that you can put pressure on from social movements to maintain its mission? So that you end up, for example, with public health that really is public health and not just being hollowed out for the benefits of, the drug companies.
Yeah.
But then also not under pressure from right-wing groups who want to ban certain procedures because their main interest is the control of women. So that's sort of the tension around that. So it's public infrastructure is not a sort of a solution that's completely going to work without maintaining that sort of popular pressure on it to make sure that it meets a diverse range of needs and is open to some kind of democratic oversight and management.
Thank you. So we need to rethink whole politics techniques also in order to make this social pressure.
Yeah, I mean, in the United States, we don't have our public health system. It's all privatized. And one of the big demands is let's build it, and that would actually be a big improvement in the United States. But then for someone like me, I look at what's going on with public health in Britain, where for trans people seeking treatment, the waiting list is 4 years to get a first appointment.
Wow.
So there's a level of interference with the delivery of regular healthcare to a particular group around a political agenda that oppresses them. But there's only one national system, so you're kind of trapped in it. So sometimes public systems aren't in the interests of particular minorities. So they're generally a good thing, but with that one caveat, that one has to, they have to be open to that kind of pressure.
Yeah, aware, so new. Okay, so thank you very much for that answer. I don't want to take too much space for the debate, so maybe we can have some questions of the audience. I don't know if anyone. Andre?
A microphone's coming to you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's been awesome. Okay. Thank you to you two. I was... it really resonates. I don't know if you've heard about this recent work of artist Ben Grosser called Minus, which is basically a social network that where you can post only 100 times. So it's like it's kind of a degrowth social network playing with giving another value to the attention. Given the design of the platform, not which to me it was like kind of mind blowing, and I was kind of wondering how can we apply the logics of the growth to technological ecosystems, and especially regarding to to attention and addiction.
I hadn't heard of that work, but I love that. And I should probably try it because I think I'm up to like 20,000 Twitter posts at this point. It's this complete like, you know, like mind suck on my attention. But how can different modes of attention be pleasurable rather than thinking there's some kind of duty or, yeah, I think that's sort of the challenge. Like, how do you create other pleasures around attention? And there's a sort of educational part in that as well. Yeah, sometimes we're deprived of the education in the kinds of attention that might give us pleasures we don't know about. So there's a role for education in that as well, I think, yeah. I had a very provincial upbringing, but I was just lucky. I had people took me to see art, and but also taught me how to look at it. So how do you create that so that we can sort of get off what I'm calling Vectra's class wants us to do with attention, get us onto other kinds of attention that we'll find equally pleasurable rather than just thinking they're a sort of a duty.
Okay, we can have maybe a few more questions over there.
Hi. When you encounter a new vector or a new source of information or a new app or something, what questions do you ask to understand to protect yourself from all the things that you were presenting about? I don't know if that makes sense. To really understand the healthy way to intake the information, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm not going to claim my ways of interacting with any of these things is healthy at all. And I'm a little resistant. I think there's sort of like a middle class thing about, you know, but I have the responsible way of doing these things, you know. And I don't want to play that card. So I'm a complete sucker for, you know, ridiculous, you know, ways of interacting on the internet that give me pleasure and allow me to, you know, like make friends. So I haven't done TikTok, but I probably will, you know, because it's like, oh, like, I do want to ask a set of formal questions about it because I'm from media studies. So I think the trick, this is like, to me, the founding idea of media theory is look at the form, not the content. So you open TikTok, I've looked at it, I don't use it regularly. It's like, oh, okay, so it's funny videos and it's teenagers dancing is a thing that works well on it. But I'm interested in the form, and that would be things like it's an algorithm that seems heavily skewed towards identifying what's popular and then like massively circulating one popular thing rather than 100. So it's very close to a broadcast model. TikTok is sort of, extracting possibilities mostly from teenagers doing dances and things like that, then picking one and that's the popular one. And it does that more heavily than Twitter does or Facebook does. So I'm trying to understand the form of it to get a little bit past the content of it. And I think that's like a useful kind of device to see how that works. But not to be too self-punishing about one's own desires for pleasure in media, but to even to use that as ways of thinking about how does this form work to extract information out of me?
Gracias. Yo quería preguntar un poco. Pensaba en que las tres tipos de contradicción de las que hablabas, de las clases, ¿no? Los campesinos y terratenientes, trabajadores y capitalistas y hackers y vectoralistas, es como que los seis están todavía existiendo y hay una interacción entre las contradicciones que se operan entre las tres, ¿no? Y si podías un poco desarrollar esto, ¿cómo entiendes que operan estas tres contradicciones a la vez?
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for that, because I skipped over that part fairly quickly. And so I'm not saying that those old class contradictions went away at all. Most people in the world are probably workers or farmers. I don't know which of those is the bigger part at the moment, and there's arguments among sociologists about that, but most people farm or work. Yeah, most people are in, you know, some sort of landlord system or in capitalism. It's more a question of, is there a dominant or an attempt to dominate that with a more abstract kind of ruling class control, and is that dependent on a new subordinate class that I'm calling hacker class? That's the producer of new information in informal content. But if you think about it as that matrix of six classes, which is already still a bit of a simplification, right? I've left out the managerial class, and I've left out the petite bourgeois, you know, sort of self-trader. I've left various pieces of it out to create a fairly simple diagram. But even just with six classes, three dominant, three subordinate, you've got a very complicated political matrix. And for me, this is the beauty of the political writings of Marx. In Capital, Marx is trying to talk about a two-class system for most of it. But in the political writings, Marx is trying to understand, oh, so Napoleon Bonaparte was operating with, you know, this incredibly complicated, you know, multi-class dynamic. And then Antonio Gramsci builds on that. So there's ways in which you can form different kinds of class alliance. There's ways in which you can attempt to mitigate the frictions that happen between worker, farmer, hacker, because they, you know, culturally they're quite different universes. So how do you cut across that so that people can organize? Maybe there's times you can exploit the tensions between different kinds of ruling class. You know, like capital is now trying to struggle to regain control over the production process. It's interesting, the struggle of the big Chinese companies that used to be manufacturers are trying to get control of information to make products under their own name. Yeah, so there's ways in which you end up with a kind of complicated diagram to try to work within. And I think that the political tactics come out of that, of trying to sort of seek out alliances and exploit contradictions. And if I can use the example of victory of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in my little district, that was very much about, in my terms, a sort of worker-hacker alliance. So service workers, who are mostly Spanish-speaking, where I'm from, like often from Colombia, but who face housing insecurity and don't have access to healthcare, how can they be in alliance with a sort of much more educated, wider English-speaking group of, you know, hacker class people, but who have this massive student debt, who are actually not really making all that much more money because they're trying to service this huge amount of debt. So how can they have common interests around, we want socialized medicine, we want rent control? Like, rent control is something both those classes shared as a common issue. So there was a way that it was the right candidate and the right slogans to get these communities that in a lot of ways don't even like each other very much. So it's not about having the same identity, but of having the same agenda and then at least getting someone into Congress. And on the state and local level, we had, I think, even more success. We got some progress on rent control in my home state through a class alliance between those two groups. So, yeah, it's useful to think in that sort of space, I think.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk and work. So, speaking about attention and tools, one of the main strategies today to get attention, retain attention from users is gamification.
Is gamification.
Yeah. So that's a very bad strategy and tool and tactics for me, because represent what the capital does to extract value from the attention of people. But I would like to know if, in your opinion, is a valuable strategy to use in our digital tools in order to work against capital tools. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And the games became a huge part of the culture industry. I wrote a book about that in 2007 called Gamer Theory, because I was interested in that. And think about games as forms that say something about... Form again, right? I'm from media studies. Games say something about the form of... I don't love the idea of like neoliberal, but you know, a better word for it, I think, is gamification. Like if you don't want to buy my argument that this is worse than capitalism, it might make more sense to call it gamified information capitalism, because it's that sense of being able to break down holding your attention to a task somebody else wants done because you'll get symbolic rewards for it, and where you're then encouraged to compete with somebody else for that symbolic reward. So going to use Twitter as the example, because I waste all my time on Twitter. I'm like, oh, what will get me more followers? Why did I just lose followers? How do I make this tweet go viral? Were you just looking at numbers, as if what made a good tweet was that 2,000 people liked it or recirculated it or something. So you sort of gamify information in that sense. But that doesn't serve anybody's interest other than, in this case, Twitter, yeah? Or some other branch of the vectoralist class. That's sort of like keeping you engaged because you think it's a game and you're competing against somebody else. I think the thing to sort of emphasize about that is we're all pretty clear that this game is kind of rigged, that, you know, all of the ways we're supposed to pass through life become gamified, but there's no level playing field. It's not really fair. Somebody else seems to get like big advantages in that you don't. So I think to sort of undermine that a little bit from within, in terms of we're told it's a level playing field, but it's really not. We don't all come into this sort of gamified world. And we don't all have to think we're sort of individual competitors against each other, yeah? I don't know if Squid Game took off here, the television show, but it's part of a whole genre that views, you know, what I'm calling vectoralism or late capitalism, call it what you like, as a sort of battle royale to the death. But how do we not think like that? How do we think that it's not in anybody's interest to participate in that? Becomes kind of key, I think. So what are other forms of collective belonging that might offer other models? My next book's about raves, because that to me seemed like a nice example of, right, I'm getting that, thank you. What are ways we can be together that aren't that? And one example's raves. Not everybody's tastes, I know, but you know, one can think of others.
Okay, so they're telling me that we ran out of time. I know that there were some questions, but maybe we can, do it after the talk. Thank you very much, everyone, for being here, for your questions. Thank you very much, Mackenzie, for these two amazing conversations with us in Barcelona. Hope we can have you again soon here.
Would be my pleasure. thank you all for those great questions. Thank you for your attention. I really appreciate it.